KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and my guest is someone who, as we discussed on this show before, is interested in storytelling and identity through storytelling, and the way that reflects on masculinity, which is certainly a kind of identity through storytelling. My guest, for whom the phrase Black History Month has recently taken on a new meaning. The first guest who's ever brought a companion animal to the show in 25 years of doing this is Joe Manganiello. First of all, Joe, thanks for coming back.
Great to see you. Great to be back.
And we've talked about this both here and privately, how much the idea of identity means to you. I was just thinking about one of the last great things you did, Max Fist, identity and public persona and who that character was in that world. But so many things that you've done, I mean, True Blood to Magic Mike, so much of that is about identity. So you were recently invited to do Finding Your Roots with Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates. And what was that first conversation?
For about 10 years, I was trying to get accepted onto a genealogy show because I had dead ends in my family history. I'm descended from an Armenian genocide survivor who lost her entire family. My great-grandmother, the Turks came in, they murdered her husband, killed seven of her children and shot her, and she didn't die. They left the eighth child to cry in the crib and starve. And she picked up the eighth child, put it on her back, escaped a death march, and made it to the Euphrates River and swam across with the baby on her back. And when she got to the other side, the baby had drowned. And now she had a bullet in her. She lived in a cave, as the story goes, and was picked up by German officers who were stationed in Turkey during World War I. There were about 25,000 of these German officers there, and one of them impregnated her while she was in the camp and left her to fend for herself. And she gave birth to my grandmother in the camp, who was blonde, half German, which, you know, the Armenians in her village were not blonde. And so, you know, she had this war baby, made her way to the United States, and we never knew who the German was. And so I wanted to find out for my mother and her sister who their grandfather was, who their mother's father was. And none of these shows would take me because technology just wasn't there genetically in order to find out who this guy was. And the paper trail obviously had run dry. And after about 10 years of trying, Finding Your Roots called me up and said, "We think we can do it now." They wound up finding out who the German was, which was, you know, a mind-blowing experience for me and my family. But they also found out lots of other things. And things that are actually in progress now. There is another huge sweater string that we are now trying to chase down. I don't know if that means a second episode, but there could be something that's even just as gigantic as some of the other revelations.
Again, just seeing that episode explains so much about you in terms of why you're built the way you are in terms of the stories you seek out. You're talking about getting that puzzle with the lost pieces. For me, that was a lost piece about you, knowing how you think about even character through identity and then how that fits into this other world. That sort of like actually stitched some things together for you that you hadn't thought about before in terms of your own definition of yourself learning these things?
Many, yes. This idea of ancestral trauma, I think, it's a conversation that I'm having a lot lately, and I find that a lot of other people are having lately. For some reason, there's been this division of mind and body in Western medicine, and it's like they're treating things chemically that shouldn't be treated chemically, or it's almost like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, where they didn't account for torque. And when the wind blew, it was turned into like a corkscrew. You know, it was like this one variable that was missing from the equation. And my life has been that way. And also when I look at my family history, it is that way. There's a couple of different ways that this manifests, but, you know, one of the ways, like, you know, we're talking about the Armenian genocide, they have lots of empirical data that the descendants of Holocaust survivors, for example, are riddled with, the families are riddled with autoimmune conditions. My grandmother, who was born in that camp, died at age 40 of lupus. There are other autoimmune conditions that have played out in the descendants of on that side of the family. It's almost like the stress and what it takes to survive something like watching your entire village, family, children murdered in front of you. That will to survive serves the survivor, but the stresses of that do not serve the descendants. And, you know, you see Western medicine trying to treat autoimmune conditions with chemicals and having limited success.
As you say this, it makes you wonder if for you that explains some part of the substance abuse in your life.
Possibly. I think that there's, you know, when you grow up the descendant of someone who survived a Holocaust, there are stresses, there are stories, there are both subconscious and conscious conditions that play out in an effort to ignore those. That's one side of my family. Then we have the other, which they discovered, which, you know, there are survivors on the other side as well.
Let me remind people, it's the treatment, my guess is, the newly multifaceted Joe Manganiello.
We're going to get into that right now.
Go see the show at kcrw.com/treatment. His genealogy, his family tree, was exhaustively resourced on this show, Finding Your Roots, hosted by Henry Louis Gates. And so, my brother, and I get this, Steve.
Little foreshadowing for everybody at home.
That you found out something that Skip Gates basically called the episode he's always wished for.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Skip called me. He's after 10 months of research. I think there were people before me that they had to call to allow the opportunity to opt out of episodes. And there were...
But there weren't many.
There were. Skip says there are a number of people that decided to not go through publicly with the episode after learning certain things.
Wow.
Now, anybody who knows that show, they'll tell you on air.
I mean, given the stuff that we've seen on that show, I mean,
I'm sure.
Yes.
So we had a
I mean, your companion on the episode found out he's related to William Shakespeare.
Yes. Yeah. You know, but there are all types of, you know, depending on what your genealogy is, there, you know, you might have ancestors that got in some trouble or weren't on the right side of history, let's say that. And so, you know, my brain was spinning because they called me and they were hoping that I would be the second person to go through with an episode after being given the opt out. And what I found, so we had a big betting pool in my family. What do you think it is? You know, what do you think they're going to say? And it wound up being something that none of us guessed.
Really? So nobody had any idea that this fact was about to be revealed?
No. I will say that I took a 23andMe, and it showed that I was 20% either British or Irish or some sort of mix, which was a shock. 20%, that's a fifth. And there was really no room for that, to my understanding, with my father and mother's genealogy. So I had my mother tested, 0% British-Irish. So it had to come from the side of my father, who was 100% Italian, or FBI, full-blooded Italian. Like, you know, when we watch Goodfellas, my father would say, see, I could get made. You kids couldn't because you're not full-blooded. Like, it was like that growing up, you know? So there was a lot of that kind of, you know, talk growing up, which was, you know, very funny. But, you know, so I thought, how could it be my father? So that got my brain thinking. Dr. Gates called me and said, first of all, we tested your DNA against every database available to us around the world, and you are related to 0% of the world's Manganiello population. I said, so wait, so that's not my last name? And he said, not technically, no. So I have the worst stage name in the history of the planet. Nobody can pronounce it. No one can spell it. I'd have like 5 million more Instagram followers if people could spell my friggin' name, you know? I said, so what is it? And he said, your father's father, Emilio John Manganiello, was not your father's father. I said, do you know who it is? And he said, we're pretty sure we do, yeah. And I said, okay. I said, can I ask you questions? He said, sure, I have the genealogy team standing by. I said, okay. I said, is he still alive? And they said, and he said, hold on. I could hear him like typing. A few seconds later, he says, no, he is no longer with us. I said, all right. Did he have any other children? He said, hold on. No, he had no other children other than your father. I said, and that's all you could tell me? And he said, yeah. And he said, we hope you do the episode, but someone needs to tell your father because of standards and practices. Because my father's alive, you can't have my father sitting there at 8 p.m. on a Tuesday going, wait, what? Or someone stopping him at the grocery store saying, hey, saw that episode. That was why they had to give me the opportunity to opt out, was because, you know, this is something that was obviously going to be very serious for my father. And, you know, and then somebody had to tell him. And so my brother called him. He agreed to a DNA test. And we were off to the races. And so then we went ahead with the episode, which was the reveal was, it was 7 hours for my sit down with Dr. Gates.
7 hours.
7 hours, which they said is about like twice as long as normal. They said in 10 years, they'd never seen anything like my genealogy as far as twists and turns. They've never seen anything like it. And like Skip was like, I've been waiting for this, you know, since I started doing genealogy.
After the DNA test was done on your dad, I mean, was he okay with that idea going along with the DNA test?
Well, he wanted to know. I mean, he's 72 years old, finding out that the man he thought was his father was not his father. So imagine that. And then aside from that, imagine finding out that you're not full-blooded Italian. And, you know, my father grew up in Boston, which is, let's use the word tribal, okay? You know, the kids in my father's neighborhood, they knew the line of demarcation on every neighborhood, and it was broken down by ethnicity. And you knew where that line was, and the kids would line up. And if you needed to get to the beach, which was through that neighborhood that was not a neighborhood of the ethnic group of your tribe, it was like kids were lining up like track runners, kids on bikes, and it was like, go, you know. Every neighborhood, whether you're Irish, of Irish descent, Italian descent, of African descent, whatever it was, everybody. And all that fighting went on in the old world. Instead of being across an ocean, everybody's just a few blocks over. So when you grow up that way, imagine finding out that you are the champion of your neighborhood, the Italians. Some kid comes down to the park and wants to fight. Out comes my dad. Now you find out you're not just Italian. You're all three. And that's the big reveal. His father, my biological grandfather, they had me read his military records. And they said, what do you see there? What is written on those lines? I said, it said Negro. And then the next one was white. The next one was Negro. The next one was white. So it was interesting that depending on the military record, depended on what his race was, a kind of backwards and forward. And I actually saw he got married and the marriage certificate said that he was white. So he would kind of pass for either white or black. But what we came to find out was that I have sub-Saharan African DNA.
And pretty substantial amount.
A substantial amount, like pretty much more than anyone who ticks the box Caucasian. And so, you know, my grandfather was of mixed race and his parents were a mixed race couple who got married in Rhode Island in the 1800s.
Which was, in addition to everything else, as Skip mentioned on the show, was illegal. My guest, who learned what the one drop rule meant on the show Finding Your Roots, is Joe Manganiello. There's more to come. Welcome back. I can see why my guest, Joe Manganiello, brought his support dog with him. It's the treatment. We're talking about his episode of Finding Your Roots, which would be on PBS February 7th, and finding out that his ancestor, his African American ancestry goes back to
mid-1700s.
To the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, prior to that, my ancestor was taken in chains from West Africa and as a boy and landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And
the name Plato is obviously a plantation name.
Plato was given, yes. I probably will never know what his real name was, obviously. But he landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts as a slave and eventually earned his freedom. 3/4 of the way through the century, joins the Continental Army, fights for the colonies against the British, which, for people that don't know, there was a lot of British propaganda at that time. It was kind of like what happened during World War II when the troops went over to fight Germany and the Germans were saying, come to us, we'll treat you right. Look at your country, you won't have the problems that you're facing here. And it was the same thing with the British. But also in hindsight, you know, the British would then offer the slaves freedom and then would not help them once the fighting was done, or would put them on ships and just send them
somewhere else to be a slave. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So there were only 5,000 Africans.
Yeah, when I heard that number, that there were that few, that I was stunned. But this had to be for you basically one piece of astonishing information after another over the course of 7 hours.
Yeah.
What's the life for you at the end of that process? I mean, because I have to tell you, it was like watching an episode of a procedural with somebody you know, having all these things happen. It was, yeah. It was just watching it. I was sort of on the edge of my seat. What was it like physically for you to go through all of that?
Well, you know, I mean, there's kind of the initial kind of taking it all in. I mean, there was so much being thrown at me. And it was like having 100-mile-per-hour fastballs just, you know, flying at, you know, I kind of needed time to process. I mean, it's been a year since we had the reveal, and that's because I hired historians and I had questions, and I've actually redone my family tree like 4 times since then, and actually have pulled another string that could be gigantic and like worthy of a second episode. For the past year, it's been like sitting with it, just letting these things kind of settle in, and so much makes sense about me. You know, I use the metaphor that it's like being incredibly nearsighted your whole life and everything is blurry. And then at 45 years old, someone hands you a pair of glasses and all of a sudden you can see yourself in the mirror clearly for the first time. And it makes sense. So many things make sense to me, you know, whether that's about, you know, my father or me or my brother and the person that I am, you know. And then from there, it's also like, I mean, I have a stack of books as high as this table that I've been getting through. I'm seeing the world differently. And I'll give you like an example. Like, you know, we went for vacation in the Bahamas. There was a restaurant called Sugar Cane. And I went, are you kidding me? I mean, they named the restaurant Sugar. I'm like, are you serious? Like, I was pissed off that someone would do that. Where, you know, I didn't know. I wouldn't have known, you know? So there's reading lists, you know, that I now have to catch up on. There is all this history that I'm catching up on because the phrase my people, there's now, I have more people.
Do you actually feel that now? I might understand. Tell me more about this. But do you actually feel that now? I mean, is this something that's been triggered in you, or are you still grappling with it? That's my question.
I mean, look, you know, I'm not going to sit here and try to pretend that I had to deal with what my friends who are of African descent had to deal with growing up. You know, I'm not trying to pretend that I'm...
Thank you.
No, please. You know, I'm Italian. I'm off white. Whatever. I think somebody referred to being Sicilian as you're off white. You're not white. You're off white. You know. You know. There's an amount of there's an amount of respect. There's an amount of, you know, understanding that I'm having in the same way that it's similar to when I first moved to LA and started meeting Armenian people, and I really started understanding what the Armenian people went through and what wasn't taught to us in school. And understanding where I came from or where my ancestors came from. And then, like I said, understanding what kind of rolls downhill off of that, you know, the difficulties. And there's a similar path on the other side.
We've had so many conversations about identity. And it's clearly something that's subterranean in you, this question about what makes us who we are and where the drama is in that. And it's fascinating that it's clearly some literal part of your makeup to ask this kind of question.
I don't know who I am in terms of a lineup. Do you know, like, if you line me up with the cast of The Sopranos, I look like some mutant giant who's a foot taller than everybody. You know, like, there's obviously something mixed in there. But then when I was working in Ireland last year, and, you know, we're wearing masks because it's COVID time, and I had a mohawk, people thought I was German. They thought there was this big German with a little dog.
Did they?
Yes. Everyone thought I was German. And I thought, oh, wow. You know, I've never thought of myself that way. But then when Skips had turned the page and showed my German great-grandfather, I look like him. His physicality, his body, his neck, his head shape, his lips, ears, brat, like, it's me. I mean, my eyes are Sicilian. Those are my grandmother's eyes. But otherwise, I look like him. So it's made it clear, kind of like, to me, you know, as an actor, where so much now about being an actor is like, who are you? What are you? What, you know, box can we put you in? I never fit one. And I never understood why, you know? And then also to understand, you know, my African descent, that's fascinating too, because there is a lot of that, I think, in me.
In what ways?
It's funny. It's just growing up, a lot of my friends were of African descent. Like, I just, growing up that way, I think culturally, I've always got along, I think. Likes, habits, friends, whatever it is, I just think it's like, oh, okay, this makes a ton of sense to me. Like, I don't know how to explain it. It's just, and maybe I'll have a better answer as time progresses, but, you know, there are things that I identify with, and I don't know how to explain it, you know?
What did your father say?
Well, my father and I, we haven't talked in a long time, so I don't know.
Because I was wondering if this actually made you him reach out or something, because I know about that estrangement. So I was wondering if he said something to you or to communicate to somebody else in the family about this.
No, there hasn't really been much talk.
But again, you talk about you having your foundation rocked. I mean, for him, and given the attitudes towards people of color, the hell in those neighborhoods, to have this kind of thing brought out to you.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be that age and to find that out. I mean, it's one thing, the genealogical side of it. It's another thing, you know, when you think about your mom and your mom having a secret and going to grave with that secret and no one on the planet knowing anything about that. And to grow up in a situation where you probably sensed that something was different.
Well, also growing up in the situation where you're constantly hiding something. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that other side of it too. And that's the awfulness. I can tell you, I had a mixed race dad who could have passed for white and chose not to. But he knew of people who did. Just imagine, in effect, always sleeping with one eye open because you're so afraid that piece of information is going to get out and change the way the entire world views you.
Right. Well, and there are things that we pick up as children consciously, and there's also things that we pick up subconsciously. And so you don't know what's being transmitted telepathically through that process, or even if his father suspected or knew. You just don't know. So what's fascinating about all of this is that in today's day and age, I know that there's been so much because of the internet about accountability, you know, and you know, because we're filming everybody all the time. But to think that scientifically, genetically, they can exhume long dead secrets that people went to the grave with.
What was it like the next day after some of the stuff had kind of settled with you? Because I know you, so I could see you hiding, being stunned.
Well, my brain was going, you know, and also,
I know the lean in when you're like, wait, what's going on? And that lean, I know. So when I saw it, it's like, oh my.
Well, and there's also a bit of it too, where, like, you know, you're being filmed. So there's a bit of it where you're like, I want to be really careful with what I say, because I mean, there's a side of like kind of what we're leaning into right now, but there's also like, oh, the son of your great grandfather was in Hitler's SS, you know, and you're like, okay, you know, how does that make you feel? It's like, how does it make me feel? You know, what do you mean? How does it make me feel? It's me also grappling with that in the moment, saying, well, There's not an ounce of me that is that. You know, my roommate in college is a very famous cantor in San Francisco. You know what I mean? Like, and I love him. You know, I just saw him a few weeks ago. Like, and what I'm doing in my brain is separating. I'm trying to, it's like Steven Pinker. You know, it's like there's a, you know, there's a blank slate thing going on where I'm like, what is genetic and what is a product of your environment? Because if that kid isn't born into Germany at that time and doesn't grow of age at a time when the Nazi party is blossoming, does he even have the option of going that way? Is there even that sentiment anywhere, you know?
But then on the other hand, you have your Plato Turner, who made a conscious choice to be part of the Continental Army at a point where Brits were saying, well, listen, you know, you're being treated as a slave. If you come and be a part of this fight, you will be part of Europe's finest and there's a place in Europe. I mean, so they have these two opposing poles, diametrically opposed in terms of the sides they chose, and we don't know why they chose these sides. There were decisions that were made.
Well, and they're grave decisions that then, you know, Plato picked the right side, because what happened after the war was he and three other freedmen were given 93 acres of land between the four of them, and they started a community called Parting Ways, in which they built like African Yoruba huts and the way that they had in Africa. So their culture was not eradicated. He came over in chains, like as awful as it is, he came over the way that he did, but wound up earning his freedom. I don't want to say like did his time, because that's awful, you know, but like he, do you know what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying. He came over in the harshest circumstances, wrested away from his ancestral home, got through that.
Right.
And ended up bringing that part of himself, even though his name was taken away from him, he still brought that essential part of himself to America in some way that shaped the culture.
And was offered this deal of land, and in some way said, okay, if they're going to be good on that, that's where I'm going to go. And I'm going to fight. He was this war hero. Like Skip wants me to be the first person ever to be inducted into the Sons of the American Revolution via DNA. Because they only go paper trail. I can't wait to show up to the reenactment. Hi, I'm here to represent my fifth great grandfather, Plato Turner. Where do I stand?
That's a great question to end it on. Where do I stand? My guest now knows where he stands is Joe Manganiello. So it's a pleasure to have him here. He is a big part of the upcoming episode of Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates, forgive me, Dr. Henry Louis Gates. Sorry, Skip. His show, Finding Your Roots on PBS on February 7th. Joe, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Actor Joe Manganiello on being the dream episode of Henry Louis Gates' show, Finding Your Roots. Joe's episode of Finding Your Roots airs February 7th on PBS. Actors on the world around them can be heard on past installments of The Treatment at kcrw.com/The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, the last time I talked to him, he was the last person I talked to live at KCRW for about a year and a half. Wow. Fortunately, he's found a way to keep himself busy. He's currently starring in, on Apple Plus TV, the new series Shrinking. Of course, talking to our old friend Jason Segel. So good to have you back here. Thank God you found someplace else to deal with your Dracula obsession.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with Dracula since I'm a kid. I try to work it into everything. Even if I have to Trojan horse it, I get it in there.
I think what's really interesting about what you tend to do as an actor, and that reflects on the last conversation we had, you've chosen so many projects about people dealing with the aftermath of trauma, be it in a comic way like Forgetting Sarah Marshall, or here. You've been choosing your own projects for a while. I wonder what it is about that particular kind of thing that seems to fascinate you so much.
I've always felt like comedy is, it's the most accessible way to access and to process any kind of difficult situation. It's how we handle it in life. You know, we get together with our friends and we laugh through our hardest moments. I personally feel like artistically, drama on top of drama, handling a dramatic situation through very serious acting can become pretty heavy, you know? But I think that, to talk about a Trojan horse, I think that one of the things that comedy does is it really brings down the defenses of the audience and makes you feel like you're hanging out with your friends. So that then when you kind of bring in this dramatic element and sort of left hook the audience with some real feeling, you're more open to processing it and dealing with it. And I guess that's why I choose stuff like this, because I think it's the best way to get at it. And then the other thing I think is I've been doing it since I was young, but I went on this kind of interesting artistic journey myself when How I Met Your Mother ended. And I had done this string of romantic comedies. And with the TV show, you're just kind of doing comedy every day. And I did that for about a decade. I mean, it was just a lot of comedy. And it was important for me to figure out what else I could do. I didn't want to be the guy who sat resentfully at dinner parties saying like, well, if I had directed The Revenant, we all know that person. So I'm like, go out there and find out, you know? And so I took a lot of dramas for a while and surrounded myself with people I admired and I watched them and I picked up some skills. So then when Shrinking came along, I felt like, okay, now you got this backpack full of stuff you've accumulated for weirdly 20 years, because I'm 43 now and I started pretty young. Let's try to put them all to the test. And so we have big physical comedy and we have scenes where I'm, you know, really missing my wife who has passed away. And being able to do all of that in one show, it was what I was looking for.
No, I just found it so interesting because even the, you're talking about Trojan horsing it, since you use that turn of phrase, I wonder if that's partially what you wanted to do with this, just because from the subject matter, we think we know what this kind of show is going to be.
I've been very interested in like this idea that we all put up a front, but what is the dirty underneath of everybody? You know, what are we actually like? That's what's really interesting to me. That's what's actually the funniest. And I also, in a stroke of self-awareness, I've been doing this a long time. I make a lot of what I do. And so I have to watch myself a lot, you know? And I've become pretty aware that because of some construction of my face or just the fact that I've played your best friend for a long, long time, I've like accumulated some currency of goodwill, right? And you always feel like even if it's the wrong stuff, I'm doing it for the right reasons and you really want me to get better, you know? And it was one of the things we talked about with a show like this, where someone is actually grieving and at rock bottom and going through a nervous breakdown and handling being a therapist in a really potentially ethically murky way. We said in the writer's room, like, push him towards unlikability. Let's not be afraid of it. I'm pretty sure I can land him back towards we're rooting for him, you know? So we do that a lot in the show. Like, the show's got some edge to it that I think is really necessary so it doesn't just feel saccharine.
We should say he's a widower with a teenage daughter who, for the first three episodes, she doesn't talk to him, which I thought was a really interesting thing to do because we're waiting for that kind of moment. Oh, boy, the fever's going to break. And it doesn't. And What's interesting is this is a show where everybody's got their lives compartmentalized. And the show itself, because it actually, we talked about that with Dispatches from Elsewhere, which is really about that too. And this idea of what compartmentalization does to the modern psyche is clearly something you're interested in too, because you're touching on that well, or dipping in that well, I should say, to not mix the metaphor, in two different shows.
Look, you're just born, man, you know? You have no idea what the point is. You're just born into this thing, and you've got like, you've got authority figures and your parents telling you what they think it's about, institutions telling you what they think the point is and what the rules might be. But really, we are all just guessing, right? We're all just bumping through this thing, making mistakes, handling stuff well, figuring it out. And all I've been able to glean is that for me, it feels like part of the point is connection, is kind of getting past this outside armor and realizing that beneath it all, we are all the same. I mean, that's really the thesis of Dispatches from Elsewhere. And so I approach everything that is about a journey of people coming together with that idea, that it's about busting through whatever's keeping us apart and coming together. And there's like spiritual beliefs that extend beyond that, that that's like actually what's happening. Someday you'll return to the source. And right now we're kind of individuated, but really we're part of the one, you know, all that stuff. But for me, on a simple level, like you look at the person across from you and I want to break down whatever is keeping us apart.
It's so funny you should say that, because I almost thought another title for the show could be Boundaries.
It is one of the big things we're all dealing with, right? Is interpersonal boundaries. And this guy's crossing boundaries with his therapy, but I think one of the things that the show is also really about is that his literal family has been destroyed through this terrible loss of his wife, and it has fallen apart. And it's about reconstructing a surrogate family from the people around him. I think that's one of the things Bill Lawrence is like amazing at, is kind of setting these characters in different quadrants, but close enough that they're always interacting with each other, and then slowly making them a family.
It's a treatment. We're talking about breaking boundaries with our old friend Jason Siegel, whose newest show about boundaries is Shrinking. It's on Apple TV Plus. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And these things you're talking about, I just found myself thinking so much about these people are really bad at sort of constructing boundaries. They kind of all think they're sort of keeping things from each other, and they're really bad at it. And I just wanted you to talk about that too, because that's also something that in the show's play for both its comedic meaning, but also for like really emotional drama pieces too.
Yeah, I think everyone is trying to protect themselves and each other throughout the show to varying degrees of success and failure. There's a lot of love between all these characters. They all want the best for each other, and they all are searching for happiness. Boundaries are really about protection, right? And so my daughter, for example, has these huge boundaries up. She, like you said, she won't speak to me for the top of the series. And it's about me breaking down those walls, but she's justified. The parental relationship is totally flipped, and she has been taking care of her father as he grieves. And I'm really delinquent in my job of recognizing that, God, it happened to her too. She lost her mom, and I'm supposed to step up and be giving her the space to grieve and taking care of her. And I've really blown it. You know, a big part of the show, one of the arc that I think relate to the most is me earning back the trust of my daughter for her to be vulnerable to me. She's right not to show me that at first. And we've got my co-therapist, Jessica Williams, who's just unbelievable in the show, who was my wife's best friend. The boundaries that she is trying to protect my neighbor, Krista Miller, has basically been parenting my daughter. And Jessica Williams steps in to tell her, like, hey, you need to back off and give Jimmy the space to become a father again.
One of my favorite scenes in the show is that scene, and like so many scenes in the show, that take a different turn, which starts off with Gabby telling Liz that she's being an intrusive parent. And then it ends up with Liz sort of saying, well, I heard what you guys are saying about me, what you thought was behind my back. There's a lot of turns like that in the show, and they're pretty intricate. And I want to talk to you about constructing that, where so often there's a pivot in the scene that sort of starts one way and turns into something else. And that's what the show is about as much as anything else, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. I got very lucky in that Bill Lawrence and Brett Goldstein, I think, are proper geniuses. And they have some experience from Ted Lasso of how to construct these things in a way that's really, really effective. I think also where our Venn diagrams align is in like a movie like Broadcast News that is so funny, so poignant, so heartbreaking, and complicated. None of the characters are villains. Everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. They're bumping up against each other. And just at the moment where you think someone is the enemy, they say something so charming. Or there's that scene where Albert Brooks is arguing with Holly Hunter and how could you do this? It violates your journalistic integrity and blah, blah, blah. And then he says, and I'm in love with you. How about that? I buried the lead. Those turns are, I mean, it's like the stuff of great writing.
So much about doing, I hate to use the phrase, sitcom. Let's just say comedy programs is about setting up a character and not having that character change. I mean, that's what comedy is, you know?
Right.
TV comedy is about stasis. And there is so much movement in this show that I just wanted to ask you about constructing, because there's a ton going on in it, and it's in constant motion.
The way we consume this stuff has changed. You know, I was on a sitcom for 9 years. And one of the things about that is, you know, the goal is to make it to syndication. And the goal of syndication is that you can check into the show at any time and not be confused, you know? So the episodes are by nature, they're repetitive and the characters aren't changing all that much. They might change in very slow sweeping arcs, but mostly you want to be able to check in and watch an episode of How I Met Your Mother, no matter where you are, no matter what time it is, you know? I think with these shows, it is much more like a movie where they're meant to be watched in order and they're meant to be watched as one story. And so you're able to write these arcs with a beginning, a middle, and an end and construct them like a 5-hour movie, which is, it's really, really dreamy because it's a little bit longer than a movie. So you get to give all of the characters rich interior lives and backstories and arcs. But, you know, there's not a lot of room for meaningless stuff either. So it really is like a beautiful genre for comedy, I think.
It is too. And that even sort of, I think, kind of appends to me to the length of the episodes, because some are substantially longer than 30 minutes and some clock in at about 30 or 31. And I just wonder that part of it too. You just like the idea, the flexibility of sort of saying, this doesn't have to have a specific beginning and end point. It just sort of stops when we feel like we're ready to move on to the next thing.
I think that's true from a storytelling standpoint. And then I think another place where Bill Lawrence is a genius is he's been doing this a long time. He's put in his 10,000 hours, you know? So there are moments where we have a cut that is 41 minutes and we're all like, uh-oh, like nothing can come out of this. And then Bill will say, I'm going to give you a cut tomorrow that's 33 minutes. And I defy you to tell me what I cut.
And really?
You watch it and he did it. And you're like, what's missing? And it's just like air, you know, it's air. And so, yeah, and I think I got really lucky to stumble into a group of geniuses here.
Having Harrison Ford, not only in it, but having Harrison Ford do comedy, which...
Yeah,
and the way you to think about, you know, he actually sort of does comedy. And hearing him talk, you kind of think he kind of is the ideal therapist because he certainly doesn't give much away. Talk about getting Harrison Ford into this thing.
So when you write a script and there's a part like Paul, you think, who would be the dream get, you know? And you're like, Harrison Ford. So then, and this happens on every project I've ever done, you offer it to Harrison Ford, knowing Harrison Ford is going to say no. But for a week, you get the fun of being able to tell people we've offered it to Harrison Ford. And it also makes your project sound exciting, even though you know in the back of your head you're never going to get Harrison Ford. But you get to say the title of your show and Harrison Ford in the same sentence, you know? And the guy said yes. And there's this moment where we're all looking at each other like, wait, Harrison Ford's going to show up? And then Harrison Ford shows up and we did the table reading. That was the first time I met him. And the guy absolutely killed in the table reading. And he was really excited. and he had worked on it and his script was all marked up and he was all in. He said, I view these things, because he was a carpenter, you know, as though someone has hired me to help build a house. And all I care about is that when we're done, the people who hired me are happy with the house. And that really stuck with me. Another thing that he does is he immediately busts through any awe that he kind of knows comes with who he is and his amazing body of work and makes you feel like a peer, which is like as generous a thing as you could hope to hear. And then the other thing that he said, which was so interesting, and I have no idea if it's true or not, but he said, you guys know more about comedy than I do. I'm here to learn. I'm here to watch and learn, and I'm open to being told how to do stuff. And no one had to tell Harrison how to do anything. But it was very interesting because you watched the episodes. You know, at the beginning, you're limited by your own imagination when you're writing. You know, you can try to picture what someone would be great at, but you just don't know for sure. You know, I learned that really early on working with Judd Apatow. Like, you know, do your best to provide the best script that you could shoot and it would be an A, but it's going to be an A plus if you give the actor some currency over their performance, you know? At first, we wrote the Harrison that we pictured, which is us doing comedy around Harrison Ford and him being gruff. And then we would be doing scenes and we would see Harrison Ford start to do moves, you know, like comedy moves. And you're like, oh, he's here to make comedy, not react to comedy. And then you get to this episode about halfway through. I don't want to give too much away. The party episode where Harrison Ford shows up unexpectedly to an engagement party.
Yes.
And it's a comedy tour de force. And I just remember this moment where Harrison Ford got a really big laugh in one of the takes. And he came over to me and he whispered, I knew I was funny. And it meant the world to me. I choose to interpret it as a like really earnest, vulnerable comment. Who knows? Maybe he was joking, but I was like, especially as performers, right? You have this unseen part of yourself that you really want to be known. And Harrison Ford is funny as hell, man.
It's the treatment. My guest, who apparently has given Harrison Ford a new lease on life in this later part of his career, is Jason Segel. His newest project is the comedy drama Shrinking on Apple TV+. You can also see the show at kcrw.com. But as you were talking about this, though, man, I was thinking about this thing I'd heard Matt Damon say about Jack Nicholson. And when they were working together, he said, you know, at a certain point, if I'm going to have a career this long, I also have to write. So if whether I get a credit or not, I'm basically coming in with ideas. And it sounds like that's what you're saying about Ford as well.
I think there's been a lot of trial and error, hopefully, by the time you've been doing this for a while. And so you have some sense that nobody else can have about what you do well and also what you want to do. You know, there's another thing that happens, which is like Harrison Ford doesn't have to work anymore if he doesn't want to. Harrison Ford's got nothing left to prove. God willing, we all arrive at that idea. I'm starting to arrive at that idea. So then it needs to turn. Like, what are you willing to trade time in your life for? Why should he do this show anyway? I ask myself that now for every project. Like, why am I willing to trade time here? I live in a beautiful town and I like walking around and there's all sorts of stuff I enjoy doing. What am I going to devote 2 years of my life to? And the thing I've arrived at is it's to answer personal questions for yourself. So I don't know. I don't want to psychoanalyze Harrison Ford, but I bet he's like, you know what? I wonder if I could pull off a comedy.
I know it's a dumb, obvious thing to say about comedy, but there's so many different kinds of timing in this show. I mean, between you and the young actor who plays your daughter, or you and Krista Miller, or you and Jessica, who seems to be revving herself up the more she talks. In some ways, yes, she's like watching a classic screwball comedy actor, but there's so much great timing in it. Or the young actor who plays a guy who starts off one way and there's something else by the end of this show. And I feel like so much of this helps, is abetted by the fact that you've got you and Brett, these guys who understand what it's like to write for actors.
Yeah. To make sure I say everybody's name, Luke Tenney is my primary patient, and he is just a tour de force in the show. And my daughter is played by Lukita Maxwell, who also, Like they're the two freshest on the show, and
they're kind of unbelievable. I mean, because she's really, she doesn't give anything away. I mean, and there are things that are dependent on us not having things given away about her. We think she's going to turn one way, and she turns a completely other direction. And he just seems to be like, sort of like lost in the moment every time he steps in front of the camera, which is kind of amazing.
He is in it and present. You know, it's funny you say this thing about timing. Like, I make music, you know, and I've always related to comedy musically. And I think the goal when you're writing for everybody is to figure out metaphorically what instrument they're playing and then make the tempos match, you know, like you got the string section moving fast, but then you got Harrison Ford coming in like a horn every once in a while. You know what I mean? Like, and the tempos can be half speed, double speed, but like they're all working in harmony. Everyone doesn't have to be moving at the same pace. And I think that's what makes things funny, is you got Jessica revving up and then you got Harrison coming in with the one note. You know, it's an orchestra comedy, I think.
So often these shows, a show about a therapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist, that person will take on an unorthodox method and somebody will shake a fist. It'll be like almost like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon by the book. But by the end, we know that this unorthodox method will be the best for everybody. That's not the case here.
No, we wanted to be really honest about that. And we also wanted to honor, you know, real therapy and acknowledge that things that are tried and true are usually for a reason, you know? And in this case, I'm trying these things that do have potentially bad repercussions. And we felt it was really important to acknowledge it. These things twist and turn to varying degrees of success and failure, like for each patient throughout it. It's not like some do well, some fail. They're constantly moving in between both of those extremes.
Finally, it's a show about consequence. How adult are you going to be about your life? Because every action does produce a result.
There's also a theme that runs through it, which is stagnation. I heard a quote once. I heard somebody say, we stop progressing when we find a level of discomfort we're willing to settle for. And I think there's some truth in therapy with that. I think there's some truth in life where you're like, all right, this is pretty good. I'm gonna rest here for the rest of my life. I was once in couples therapy and the therapist said, the fact that you're even working on this shows some high level care. Most people just pick a partner and bump up against them until one of them dies. And I think that's true, you know? And one of the things that this show talks about is like snapping yourself out of these periods of I'm willing to settle for this level of discomfort. Like, no, let's get out of this hole, and not just a little bit out. Like, let's get all the way out together.
Well, my guest who's probably given the most trenchant relationship advice in the history of public radio is Jason Segel. His new show Apple TV Plus is Shrinking, and it's always a pleasure to talk to him. Jason, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks so much, man. I loved it. When I can go therapy 2 times a day, why would I spend the rest of this week so bitter?
Actor, writer Jason Segel, on returning to TV with the Apple TV Plus show Shrinking. You can return to previous episodes of this show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. When I can go therapy 2 times a day, I don't want to be around me. And I don't blame you if you're blocking all my calls. Been a while since I've been sleeping soundly. Most nights I lie awake. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Writer-director Elegance Bratton on Diego Velázquez and perhaps a new definition of chiaroscuro.
Hi, I'm Elegance Bratton, and this is The Treat. One of my favorite paintings is Portrait of a Slave by Velázquez. the great Spanish painter. Some people consider it to be one of the greatest paintings of all time. It's one of my favorites for sure. But what's interesting is that the slave that's being rendered is Velázquez's assistant. So there's always a question when I look at it where it's like, did Velázquez paint this or did the enslaved guy paint this? And if so, does that mean that he's actually one of the greatest painters of all time and that we've always had a great classical Black painter? We just never looked at it that way because his work was owned by, his owner. Kind of reminds me of the 1930s version of Imitation of Life. The storyline is that the Black woman, the maid in the character, ends up coming up with a pancake recipe that's like really, really good, that her employers, this kind of white actress who goes from being, you know, washed up to being like a big star, ends up co-opting from her and selling this pancake recipe and getting rich. When we're trafficking in ideas, oftentimes the benefit is kind of in the order of operations. Whoever does which part of the process first gets the credit, even though many other people can be responsible, like Andy Warhol's factory. So all that to say, this painting, which I think is like a 17th century painting, but I think it kind of presages the notions that someone like Andy Warhol introduces later in the 20th century. Did Juan paint it? Because if Juan painted it, then I'm looking at Velázquez's whole oeuvre a different way, because that means he's painting all of them, you know? So, yes, that's one of my favorite things in the world.
Storyteller Elegance Bratton on painter Velázquez and perhaps the storied portrait of Juan de Pareja. More stories of inspiration by the creative forces who make work that continues to inspire are available at kcrw.com/thetreat. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist, with help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Gondarajan. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.